Thursday, January 18, 1906. Senator Tillman speaks of Morris case, funeral of John Malone contrasted with funeral of Empress of Austria, leads up to dueling. Senator Tillman of South Carolina has been making a speech, day before yesterday, of frank and intimate criticism of the President of the United States, as he calls him, whereas, so far as my knowledge goes, there has been no such functionary as President of the United States for 40 years, perhaps, if we except Cleveland. I do not call to mind any other President of the United States, there may have been one or two, perhaps one or two, who were not always and persistently Presidents of the Republican Party, but were now and then for a brief interval really Presidents of the United States. Tillman introduces into this speech the matter of the expulsion of Mrs. Morris from the White House, and I think his arraignment of the President was a good and capable piece of work. At any rate, his handling of it suited me very well and tasted very good in my mouth. I was glad that there was somebody to take this matter up, whether from a generous motive or from an ungenerous one, and give it an airing. It was needed. The whole nation and the entire press have been sitting by in meek and slavish silence, everybody privately wishing, just as was my own case, that some person with some sense of the proprieties would rise up and denounce this outrage as it ought to be denounced. Tillman makes a point which charms me. I wanted to use it myself days ago, but I was already arranging a scheme in another matter of public concern, which may invite a brick or two in my direction, and one entertainment of this sort at a time is plenty for me. That point was this, that the President is always prodigal of letters and telegrams to Tom, Dick, and Harry about everything and nothing. He seems never to lack time from his real duties to attend to duties that do not exist. So at the very time when he should have been throwing off one or two little lines to say to Mrs. Morris and her friends that, being a gentleman, he was hastening to say he was sorry that his idiot assistant secretary had been turning the nation's official mansion into a sailor boarding house, and that he would admonish Mr. Barnes and the rest of the reception room garrison to deal more gently with the erring in future, and to abstain from any conduct in the White House which would rank as disgraceful in any other respectable dwelling in the land. I don't like Tillman. His second cousin killed an editor 3 years ago without giving that editor a chance to defend himself. I recognize that it is almost always wise, and is often in a manner necessary, to kill an editor, but I think that when a man is a United States Senator, he ought to require his second cousin to refrain as long as he can, and then do it in a handsome way, running some personal risk himself. I have not known Tillman to do many things that were greatly to his credit during his political life, but I am glad of the position which he has taken this time. The President has persistently refused to listen to such friends of his as are not insane, men who have tried to persuade him to disavow Mr. Barnes's conduct and express regret for that occurrence. And now Mr. Tillman uses that point which I spoke of a minute ago, and uses it with telling effect. He reminds the Senate that at the very time that the President's dignity would not allow him to send to Mrs. Morris or her friends a kindly and regretful line, he had time enough to send a note of compliment and admiration to a prize fighter in the far West. If the President had been an unpopular person, that point would have been seized upon early, and much and disastrous notice taken of it. But as I have suggested before, the nation and the newspapers have maintained a loyal and humiliated silence about it, and have waited prayerfully and hopefully for some reckless person to say the things which were in their hearts, and which they could not bear to utter. Mrs. Morris embarrasses the situation, and extends and keeps alive the discomfort of 80 millions of people, by lingering along near to death, yet neither rallying nor dying. To do either would relieve the tension. For the present, the discomfort must continue. Mr. Tillman certainly has not chloroformed it. That birthday speech of mine was the text which I meant to use along here. I don't want to get too far away from it at any one time, and I ought to get back to that. We buried good old John Malone, the actor, this morning. His old friends of the Players Club attended in a body. It was the second time in my life that I had been present at a Catholic funeral. And as I sat in the church, my mind went back, by natural process, to that other one, and the contrast strongly interested me. That first one was the funeral of the Empress of Austria, who was assassinated 6 or 8 years ago. There was a great concourse of the ancient nobility of the Austrian Empire, and as that patchwork of old kingdoms and principalities consists of 19 states and 11 nationalities, And as these nobles came clothed in the costumes which their ancestors were accustomed to wear on state occasions 3 or 4 or 5 centuries ago, the variety and magnificence of the costumes made a picture which cast far into the shade all the notions of splendor and magnificence which in the course of my life I had accumulated from the opera, the theater, the picture galleries, and from books. Gold, silver, jewels, silks, satins, velvets. They were all there in brilliant and beautiful confusion, and in that sort of perfect harmony which nature herself observes and is master of, when she paints and groups her flowers and her forests and floods them with sunshine. The military and civic milliners of the Middle Ages knew their trade. Infinite as was the variety of the costumes displayed, there was not an ugly one, nor one that was a discordant note in the harmony, or an offense to the eye. When those masked costumes were still, they were softly, richly, sensuously beautiful. When the mass stirred, the slightest movement set the jewels and metals and bright colors afire, and swept it with flashing lights, which sent a sort of ecstasy of delight through me. But it was different this morning. This morning the clothes were all alike. They were simple and devoid of color. The players were clothed as they are always clothed, except that they wore the high silk hat of ceremony. Yet in its way, John Malone's funeral was as impressive as had been that of the Empress. There was no inequality between John Malone and the Empress, except the artificial inequalities which have been invented and established by man's childish vanity. The Empress and John were just equals in the essentials of goodness of heart and a blameless life. Both passed by the onlooker in their coffins, respected, esteemed, honored. Both traveled the same road from the church, bound for the same resting place, according to Catholic doctrine, purgatory, to be removed thence to a better land or to remain in purgatory accordingly as the contributions of their friends in cash or prayer shall determine. The priest told us in an admirably framed speech about John's destination and the terms upon which he might continue his journey or must remain in purgatory. John was poor. His friends are poor. The Empress was rich. Her friends are rich. John Malone's prospects are not good, and I lament it. Perhaps I am in error in saying that I have been present at only 2 Catholic funerals. I think I was present at one in Virginia City, Nevada, in the neighborhood of 40 years ago, or perhaps it was down in Esmeralda, on the borders of California. But if it happened, the memory of it can hardly be said to exist, it is so indistinct. I did attend 1 or 2 funerals, maybe a dozen out there, funerals of desperados who had tried to purify society by exterminating other desperados, and did accomplish the purification, though not according to the program which they had laid out for this office. Also, I attended some funerals of persons who had fallen in duels, and maybe it was a duelist whom I helped to ship. But would a duelist be buried by the church? In inviting his own death, wouldn't he be committing suicide substantially? Wouldn't that rule him out? Well, I don't remember how it was now, but I think it was a duelist. Friday, January 19th, 1906. About dueling. In those early days, dueling suddenly became a fashion in the new territory of Nevada, and by 1864 everybody was anxious to have a chance in the new sport, mainly for the reason that he was not able to thoroughly respect himself so long as he had not killed or crippled somebody in a duel or been killed or crippled in one himself. At that time, I had been serving as city editor on Mr. Goodman's Virginia City Enterprise for a matter of 2 years. I was 29 years old. I was ambitious in several ways, but I had entirely escaped the seductions of that particular craze. I had had no desire to fight a duel. I had no intention of provoking one. I did not feel respectable, but I got a certain amount of satisfaction out of feeling safe. I was ashamed of myself. The rest of the staff were ashamed of me. But I got along well enough. I had always been accustomed to feeling ashamed of myself for one thing or another, so there was no novelty for me in the situation. I bore it very well. Plunkett was on the staff. R.M. Daggett was on the staff. These had tried to get into duels, but for the present had failed and were waiting. Goodman was the only one of us who had done anything to shed credit upon the paper. The rival paper was the Virginia Union. Its editor for a little while was Tom Fitch, called the Silver-Tongued Orator of Wisconsin. That was where he came from. He tuned up his oratory in the editorial columns of the Union, and Mr. Goodman invited him out and modified him with a bullet. I remember the joy of the staff when Goodman's challenge was accepted by Fitch. We ran late that night and made much of Joe Goodman. He was only 24 years old. He lacked the wisdom which a person has at 29, and he was as glad of being it as I was that I wasn't. He chose Major Graves for his second. That name is not right, but it's close enough. I don't remember the major's name. Graves came over to instruct Joe in the dueling art. He had been a major under Walker, the gray-eyed man of destiny, and had fought all through that remarkable man's filibustering campaign in Central America. That fact gauges the major. To say that a man was a major under Walker and came out of that struggle ennobled by Walker's praise is to say that the major was not merely a brave man, but that he was brave to the very utmost limit of that word. All of Walker's men were like that. I knew the Gillis family intimately. The father made the campaign under Walker, and with him one son. They were in the memorable Plaza fight and stood it out to the last against overwhelming odds, as did also all of the Walker men. The son was killed at the father's side. The father received a bullet through the eye. The old man, for he was an old man at the time, wore spectacles, and the bullet and one of the glasses went into his skull and remained there. But often in after years, when I boarded in the old man's home in San Francisco, whenever he became emotional, I used to see him shed tears and glass in a way that was infinitely moving. It is wonderful how glass breeds when it has a fair chance. This glass was all broken up and ruined, so it had no market value, but in the course of time he exuded enough to set up a spectacle shop with. There were some other sons, Steve, George, and Jim, very young chaps, the merest lads, who wanted to be in the Walker expedition, for they had their father's dauntless spirit. But Walker wouldn't have them. He said it was a serious expedition and no place for children. The major was a majestic creature with a most stately and dignified and impressive military bearing, and he was by nature and training courteous, polite, graceful, winning. And he had that quality which I think I have encountered in only one other man, Bob Howland, a mysterious quality which resides in the eye, and when that eye is turned upon an individual or a squad in warning, that is enough. The man that has that eye doesn't need to go armed. He can move upon an armed desperado and quell him and take him prisoner without saying a single word. I saw Bob Howland do that once, a slender, good-natured, amiable, gentle, kindly little skeleton of a man, with a sweet blue eye that would win your heart when it smiled upon you, or turn cold and freeze it, according to the nature of the occasion. The major stood Joe up straight, stood Steve Gillis up 15 paces away, made Joe turn his right side towards Steve, cock his Navy six-shooter, that prodigious weapon, and hold it straight down against his leg, told him that that was the correct position for the gun, that the position ordinarily in use at Virginia City, that is to say the gun straight up in the air, then brought slowly down to your man, was all wrong. At the word one, you must raise the gun slowly and steadily to the place on the other man's body that you desire to convince. Then after a pause, two, three, fire! Stop. At the word stop, you may fire, but not earlier. You may give yourself as much time as you please after that word. Then, when you fire, you may advance and go on firing at your leisure and pleasure, if you can get any pleasure out of it. And in the meantime, the other man, if he has been properly instructed and is alive to his privileges, is advancing on you and firing, and it is always likely that more or less trouble will result. Naturally, when Joe's revolver had risen to a level, it was pointing at Steve's breast, but the major said, "No, that is not wise. Take all the risks of getting murdered yourself, but don't run any risk of murdering the other man. If you survive a duel, you want to survive it in such a way that the memory of it will not linger along with you through the rest of your life and interfere with your sleep. Aim at your man's leg, not at the knee, not above the knee, for those are dangerous spots. Aim below the knee. Cripple him, but leave the rest of him to his mother." By grace of these truly wise and excellent instructions, Joe tumbled his man down with a bullet through his lower leg, which furnished him a permanent limp. And Joe lost nothing but a lock of hair, which he could spare better then than he could now, for when I saw him here in New York a year ago, his crop was gone. He had nothing much left but a fringe with a dome rising above. About a year later, I got my chance. but I was not hunting for it. Goodman went off to San Francisco for a week's holiday and left me to be chief editor. I'd supposed that that was an easy berth, there being nothing to do but write one editorial per day, but I was disappointed in that superstition. I couldn't find anything to write an article about the first day. Then it occurred to me that inasmuch as it was the 22nd of April, 1864, the next morning would be the 300th anniversary of Shakespeare's birthday. And what better theme could I want than that? I got the Cyclopedia and examined it and found out who Shakespeare was and what he had done, and I borrowed all that and laid it before a community that couldn't have been better prepared for instruction about Shakespeare than if they had been prepared by art. There wasn't enough of what Shakespeare had done to make an editorial of the necessary length, but I filled it out with what he hadn't done, which in many respects was more important and striking and readable than the handsomest things he had really accomplished. But next day I was in trouble again. There were no more Shakespeares to work up. There was nothing in past history or in the world's future possibilities to make an editorial out of, suitable to that community. So there was but one theme left. That theme was Mr. Laird, proprietor of the Virginia Union. His editor had gone off to San Francisco, too, and Laird was trying his hand at editing. I woke up Mr. Laird with some courtesies of the kind that were fashionable among newspaper editors in that region, and he came back at me the next day in the most vitriolic way. He was hurt by something I had said about him, some little thing, I don't remember what it was now. Probably called him a horse thief or one of those little phrases customarily used to describe another editor. They were no doubt just and accurate, but Laird was a very sensitive creature, and he didn't like it. So we expected a challenge from Mr. Laird, because according to the rules, according to the etiquette of dueling as reconstructed and reorganized and improved by the duelists of that region, whenever you said a thing about another person that he didn't like, it wasn't sufficient for him to talk back in the same offensive spirit. Etiquette required him to send a challenge. So we waited for a challenge. Waited all day. It didn't come, and as the day wore along, hour after hour, and no challenge came, the boys grew depressed. They lost heart. But I was cheerful. I felt better and better all the time. They couldn't understand it, but I could understand it. It was my make that enabled me to be cheerful when other people were despondent. So then it became necessary for us to waive etiquette and challenge Mr. Laird. When we reached that decision, they began to cheer up, but I began to lose some of my animation. However, in enterprises of this kind, you are in the hands of your friends. There is nothing for you to do but to abide by what they consider to be the best course. Daggett wrote a challenge for Daggett had the language, the right language, the convincing language, and I lacked it. Daggett poured out a stream of unsavory epithets upon Mr. Laird, charged with the vigor and venom of a strength calculated to persuade him. And Steve Gillis, my second, carried the challenge and came back to wait for the return. It didn't come. The boys were exasperated, but I kept my temper. Steve carried another challenge, hotter than the other, and we waited again. Nothing came of it. I began to feel quite comfortable. I began to take an interest in the challenges myself. I had not felt any before, but it seemed to me that I was accumulating a great and valuable reputation at no expense, and my delight in this grew and grew as challenge after challenge was declined, until by midnight I was beginning to think that there was nothing in the world so much to be desired as a chance to fight a duel. So I hurried Daggett up, made him keep on sending challenge after challenge. Oh, well, I overdid it. Laird accepted. I might have known that that would happen. Laird was a man you couldn't depend on. The boys were jubilant beyond expression. They helped me make my will, which was another discomfort, and I already had enough. Then they took me home. I didn't sleep any, didn't want to sleep. I had plenty of things to think about and less than 4 hours to do it in, because 5 o'clock was the hour appointed for the tragedy, and I should have to use up 1 hour, beginning at 4, in practicing with the revolver and finding out which end of it to level at the adversary. At 4, we went down into a little gorge, about a mile from town, and borrowed a barn door for a mark, borrowed it of a man who was over in California on a visit. And we set the barn door up and stood a fence rail up against the middle of it to represent Mr. Laird. But the rail was no proper representative of him, for he was longer than a rail and thinner. Nothing would ever fetch him but a line shot, and then, as like as not, he would split the bullet, the worst material for dueling purposes that could be imagined. I began on the rail. I couldn't hit the rail. Then I tried the barn door, but I couldn't hit the barn door. There was nobody in danger except stragglers around on the flanks of that mark. I was thoroughly discouraged, and I didn't cheer up any when we presently heard pistol shots over in the next little ravine. I knew what that was. That was Zlaird's gang out practicing him. They would hear my shots, and of course they would come up over the ridge to see what kind of a record I was making, see what their chances were against me. Well, I hadn't any record, and I knew that if Laird came over that ridge and saw my barn door without a scratch on it, he would be as anxious to fight as I was, or as I had been at midnight before that disastrous acceptance came. Now, just at this moment, a little bird, no bigger than a sparrow, flew along by and lit on a sage bush about 30 yards away. Steve whipped out his revolver and shot its head off. Oh, he was a marksman, much better than I was. We ran down there to pick up the bird, and just then, sure enough, Mr. Laird and his people came over the ridge, and they joined us. And when Laird's second saw that bird with its head shot off, he lost color. He faded, and you could see that he was interested. He said, "Who did that?" Before I could answer, Steve spoke up and said quite calmly, in a matter-of-fact way, "Clemens did it." The second said, "Why, that is wonderful. How far off was that bird?" Steve said, "Oh, not far, about 30 yards. The second said, "Well, that is astonishing shooting. How often can he do that?" Steve said languidly, "Oh, about 4 times out of 5. I knew the little rascal was lying, but I didn't say anything. The second said, "Why, that is amazing shooting. I supposed he couldn't hit a church." He was supposing very sagaciously, but I didn't say anything. Well, they said good morning. The second took Mr. Laird home, a little tottery on his legs, and Laird sent back a note in his own hand, declining to fight a duel with me on any terms whatever. Well, my life was saved. Saved by that accident. I don't know what the bird thought about that interposition of Providence, but I felt very, very comfortable over it, satisfied and content. Now, we found out later that Laird had hit his mark 4 times out of 6 right along. If the duel had come off, he would have so filled my skin with bullet holes that it wouldn't have held my principles. By breakfast time, the news was all over town that I had sent a challenge and Steve Gillis had carried it. Now, that would entitle us to 2 years apiece in the penitentiary, according to the brand new law. Judge North sent us no messages coming from himself, but a message came from a close friend of his. He said it would be a good idea for us to leave the territory by the first stagecoach. This would sail next morning at 4 o'clock, and in the meantime, we would be searched for, but not with avidity. And if we were in the territory after that stagecoach left, we would be the first victims of the new law. Judge North was anxious to have some object lessons for that law, and he would absolutely keep us in the prison the full 2 years. He wouldn't pardon us out to please anybody. Well, it seemed to me that our society was no longer desirable in Nevada, so we stayed in our quarters and observed proper caution all day, except that once Steve went over to the hotel to attend to another customer of mine. That was a Mr. Cutler. You see, Laird was not the only person whom I had tried to reform during my occupancy of the editorial chair. I had looked around and selected several other people and delivered a new zest of life into them through warm criticism and disapproval. So that when I laid down my editorial pen, I had 4 horsewhippings and 2 duels owing to me. We didn't care for the horsewhippings. There was no glory in them. They were not worth the trouble of collecting. But honor required that some notice should be taken of that other duel. Mr. Cutler had come up from Carson City and had sent a man over with a challenge from the hotel. Steve went over to pacify him. Steve weighed only 95 pounds, but it was well known throughout the territory that with his fists he could whip anybody that walked on 2 legs, let his weight and science be what they might. Steve was a Gillis, and when a Gillis confronted a man and had a proposition to make, the proposition always contained business. When Cutler found that Steve was my second, he cooled down. He became calm and rational and was ready to listen. Steve gave him 15 minutes to get out of the hotel and 30 minutes to get out of town, or there would be results. So that duel went off successfully because Mr. Cutler immediately left for Carson, a convinced and reformed man. I have never had anything to do with duels since. I thoroughly disapprove of duels. I consider them unwise, and I know they are dangerous, also sinful. If a man should challenge me now, I would go to that man and take him kindly and forgivingly by the hand, and lead him to a quiet, retired spot, and kill him. Still, I have always taken a great interest in other people's duels. One always feels an abiding interest in any heroic thing which has entered into his own experience. In 1878, 14 years after my unmaterialized duel, Messieurs Fortu and Gambetta fought a duel which made heroes of both of them in France, but made them rather ridiculous throughout the rest of the world. I was living in Munich that fall and winter, and I was so interested in that funny tragedy that I wrote a long account of it, and it is in one of my books, somewhere, an account which had some inaccuracies in it, but as an exhibition of the spirit of that duel, I think it was correct and trustworthy. And when I was living in Vienna, 34 years after my ineffectual duel, my interest in that kind of incident was still strong. And I find here among my autobiographical manuscripts of that day a chapter which I began concerning it, but did not finish. I wanted to finish it, but held it open in the hope that the Italian ambassador, Monsieur Nigra, would find time to furnish me the full history of Signor Cavallotti's adventures in that line. But he was a busy man. There was always an interruption before he could get well started, so my hope was never fulfilled. The following is the unfinished chapter. As concerns dueling, this pastime is as common in Austria today as it is in France, but with this difference, that here in the Austrian states the duel is dangerous, while in France it is not. Here it is tragedy, in France it is comedy, here it is a solemnity, there it is monkey shines. Here the duelist risks his life, there he does not even risk his shirt. Here he fights with pistol or saber, in France with a hairpin, a blunt one. Here the desperately wounded man tries to walk to the hospital. There they paint the scratch so that they can find it again, lay the sufferer on a stretcher and conduct him off the field with a band of music. At the end of a French duel, the pair hug and kiss and cry and praise each other's valor. Then the surgeons make an examination and pick out the scratched one, and the other one helps him onto the litter and pays his fare. And in return, the scratched one treats to champagne and oysters in the evening, and then the incident is closed, as the French say. It is all polite and gracious and pretty and impressive. At the end of an Austrian duel, the antagonist that is alive gravely offers his hand to the other man, utters some phrases of courteous regret, then bids him goodbye and goes his way. And that incident also is closed. The French duelist is painstakingly protected from danger by the rules of the game. His antagonist's weapon cannot reach so far as his body. If he get a scratch, it will not be above his elbow. But in Austria, the rules of the game do not provide against danger. They carefully provide for it, usually. Commonly, the combat must be kept up until one of the men is disabled. A non-disabling slash or stab does not retire him. For a matter of 3 months, I watched the Viennese journals, and whenever a duel was reported in their telegraphic columns, I scrapbooked it. By this record, I find that dueling in Austria is not confined to journalists and old maids, as in France, but is indulged in by military men, journalists, students, physicians, lawyers, members of the legislature, and even the cabinet, the bench, and the police. Dueling is forbidden by law. And so it seems odd to see the makers and administrators of the laws dancing on their work in this way. Some months ago, Count Badeni, at that time chief of the government, fought a pistol duel here in the capital city of the empire with Representative Wolf, and both of those distinguished Christians came near getting turned out of the church, for the church as well as the state forbids dueling. In one case, lately, in Hungary, the police interfered and stopped a duel after the first innings. This was a saber duel between the chief of police and the city attorney. Unkind things were said about it by the newspapers. They said the police remembered their duty uncommonly well when their own officials were the parties concerned in duels. But I think the underlings showed good bread-and-butter judgment. If their superiors had carved each other well, the public would have asked, where were the police? And their places would have been endangered. But custom does not require them to be around where mere unofficial citizens are explaining a thing with sabers. There was another duel, a double duel, going on in the immediate neighborhood at the time, and in this case the police obeyed custom and did not disturb it. Their bread and butter was not at stake there. In this duel, a physician fought a couple of surgeons and wounded both, one of them lightly, the other seriously. An undertaker wanted to keep people from interfering, but that was quite natural again. Selecting at random from my record, I next find a duel at Tarnopol between military men. An officer of the 10th Dragoons charged an officer of the 9th Dragoons with an offense against the laws of the card table. There was a defect or a doubt somewhere in the matter, and this had to be examined and passed upon by a court of honor. So the case was sent up to Lemberg for this purpose. One would like to know what the defect was, but the newspaper does not say. A man here who has fought many duels and has a graveyard says that probably the matter in question was as to whether the accusation was true or not. That if the charge was a very grave one, cheating for instance, proof of its truth would rule the guilty officer out of the field of honor. The court would not allow a gentleman to fight with such a person. You see what a solemn thing it is. You see how particular they are. Any little careless act can lose you your privilege of getting yourself shot here. The court seems to have gone into the matter in a searching and careful fashion. For several months elapsed before it reached a decision. It then sanctioned a duel, and the accused killed his accuser. Next, I find a duel between a prince and a major, first with pistols, no result satisfactory to either party, then with sabers, and the major badly hurt. Next, a saber duel between journalists, the one a strong man, the other feeble and in poor health. It was brief. The strong one drove his sword through the weak one, and death was immediate. Next, a duel between a lieutenant and a student of medicine. According to the newspaper report, these are the details. The student was in a restaurant one evening. Passing along, he halted at a table to speak with some friends. Nearby sat a dozen military men. The student conceived that one of these was staring at him. He asked the officer to step outside and explain. This officer and another one gathered up their caps and sabers and went out with the student. Outside, this is the student's account, the student introduced himself to the offending officer and said, "You seemed to stare at me." For answer, the officer struck at the student with his fist. The student parried the blow. Both officers drew their sabers and attacked the young fellow, and one of them gave him a wound on the left arm. Then they withdrew. This was Saturday night. The duel followed on Monday in the military riding school, the customary dueling ground all over Austria, apparently. The weapons were pistols. The dueling terms were somewhat beyond custom in the matter of severity, if I may gather that from the statement that the combat was fought unter sehr schweren Bedingungen, to wit, distance 15 steps, with 3 steps advance. There was but one exchange of shots. The student was hit. He put his hand on his breast. His body began to bend slowly forward, then collapsed in death and sank to the ground. It is pathetic. There are other duels in my list, but I find in each and all of them one and the same ever-recurring defect. The principals are never present, but only their sham representatives. The real principals in any duel are not the duelists themselves, but their families. They do the mourning, the suffering. Theirs is the loss, and theirs the misery. They stake all that. The duelist stakes nothing but his life, and that is a trivial thing compared with what his death must cost those whom he leaves behind him. Challenges should not mention the duelist. He has nothing much at stake, and the real vengeance cannot reach him. The challenge should summon the offender's old gray mother and his young wife and his little children, these or any to whom he is a dear and worshipped possession, and should say, "You have done me no harm, but I am the meek slave of a custom which requires me to crush the happiness out of your hearts and condemn you to years of pain and grief, in order that I may wash clean with your tears a stain which has been put upon me by another person." The logic of it is admirable. A person has robbed me of a penny. I must beggar 10 innocent persons to make good my loss. Surely nobody's honor is worth all that. Since the duelist's family are the real principals in a duel, the state ought to compel them to be present at it. Custom also ought to be so amended as to require it, and without it no duel ought to be allowed to go on. If that student's unoffending mother had been present and watching the officer through her tears as he raised his pistol, he would have fired in the air. We know that, for we know how we are all made. Laws ought to be based upon the ascertained facts of our nature. It would be a simple thing to make a dueling law which would stop dueling. As things are now, the mother is never invited. She submits to this, and without outward complaint, for she too is the vassal of custom, and custom requires her to conceal her pain when she learns the disastrous news that her son must go to the dueling field. And by the powerful force that is lodged in habit and custom, she is enabled to obey this trying requirement, a requirement which exacts a miracle of her and gets it. Last January, a neighbor of ours who has a young son in the army was wakened by this youth at 3 o'clock one morning, and she sat up in bed and listened to his message. "I have come to tell you something, mother, which will distress you, but you must be good and brave and bear it. I have been affronted by a fellow officer, and we fight at 3 this afternoon. Lie down and sleep now, and think no more about it." She kissed him good night and lay down, paralyzed with grief and fear, but said nothing. But she did not sleep. She prayed and mourned till the first streak of dawn, then fled to the nearest church and implored the Virgin for help. And from that church she went to another, and another, and another, church after church, and still church after church, and so spent all the day until 3 o'clock on her knees in agony and tears, then dragged herself home and sat down, comfortless and desolate, to count the minutes and wait with an outward show of calm for what had been ordained for her, happiness or endless misery. Presently she heard the clank of a saber. She had not known before what music was in that sound, and her son put his head in and said X was in the wrong, and he apologized. So that incident was closed, and for the rest of her life the mother will always find something pleasant about the clank of a saber, no doubt. In one of my listed duels, however, let it go. There is nothing particularly striking about it, except that the seconds interfered, and prematurely too, for neither man was dead. This was certainly irregular. Neither of the men liked it. It was a duel with cavalry sabers between an editor and a lieutenant. The editor walked to the hospital. The lieutenant was carried. In this country, an editor who can write well is valuable, but he is not likely to remain so unless he can handle a saber with charm. The following very recent telegram shows that also in France, duels are humanely stopped as soon as they approach the French danger point. The duel between Colonels Henri and Picard took place this morning in the riding school of the École Militaire, the doors of which were strictly guarded in order to prevent intrusion. The combatants who fought with swords were in position at 10 o'clock. At the first re-engagement, Lieutenant Colonel Henri was slightly scratched in the forearm, and just at the same moment his own blade appeared to touch his adversary's neck. Senator Ranc, who was Colonel Picard's second, stopped the fight. But as it was found that his principal had not been touched, the combat continued. A very sharp encounter ensued, in which Colonel Henri was wounded in the elbow, and the duel then terminated. After which, the stretcher and the band. In lurid contrast with this delicate flirtation, we have this fatal duel of day before yesterday in Italy, where the earnest Austrian duel is in vogue. I knew Cavallotti slightly, and this gives me a sort of personal interest in his duel. I first saw him in Rome several years ago. He was sitting on a block of stone in the Forum and was writing something in his notebook, a poem or a challenge or something like that, and the friend who pointed him out to me said, "That is Cavallotti. He has fought 30 duels. Do not disturb him." I did not disturb him. May 13th, 1907. It is a long time ago. Cavallotti, poet, orator, satirist, statesman, patriot, was a great man, and his death was deeply lamented by his countrymen. Many monuments to his memory testify to this. In his duels, he killed several of his antagonists and disabled the rest. By nature, he was a little irascible. Once when the officials of the Library of Bologna threw out his books, the gentle poet went up there and challenged the whole 15. His parliamentary duties were exacting, but he proposed to keep coming up and fighting duels between trains until all those officials had been retired from the activities of life. Although he always chose the sword to fight with, he had never had a lesson with that weapon. When game was called, he waited for nothing, but always plunged at his opponent and rained such a storm of wild and original thrusts and whacks upon him that the man was dead or crippled before he could bring his science to bear. But his latest antagonist discarded science and won. He held his sword straight forward like a lance when Cavallotti made his plunge, with the result that he impaled himself upon it. It entered his mouth and passed out at the back of his neck. Death was instantaneous. Tuesday, January 23, 1906. About the meeting at Carnegie Hall, in interest of Booker Washington's Tuskegee Institute, leads up to unpleasant political incident which happened to Mr. Twitchell. There was a great mass meeting at Carnegie Hall last night in the interest of Booker Washington's Tuskegee Educational Institute in the South. The interest which New York people feel in that institute was quite manifest in the fact that although it was not pleasant weather, there were 3,000 people inside the hall and 2,000 outside who were trying to get in when the performances were ready to begin at 8 o'clock. Mr. Choate presided and was received with a grand welcome when he marched in upon the stage. He is fresh from his long stay in England as our ambassador, where he won the English people by the gifts of his heart, and won the royalties and the government by his able diplomatic service, and captured the whole nation with his fine and finished oratory. For 35 years, Choate has been the handsomest man in America. Last night he seemed to me to be just as handsome as he was 35 years ago when I first knew him. And when I used to see him in England, 5 or 6 years ago, I thought him the handsomest man in that country. It was at a 4th of July reception in Mr. Choate's house in London that I first met Booker Washington. I have met him a number of times since, and he always impresses me pleasantly. Last night he was a mulatto. I didn't notice it until he turned while he was speaking and said something to me. It was a great surprise to me to see that he was a mulatto and had blue eyes. How unobservant a dull person can be. Always before, he was black to me, and I had never noticed whether he had eyes at all or not. He has accomplished a wonderful work in this quarter of a century. When he finished his education at the Hampton Colored School 25 years ago, he was unknown, and hadn't a penny nor a friend outside his immediate acquaintanceship. But by the persuasion of his carriage and address and the sincerity and honesty that look out of his eyes, he has been enabled to gather money by the hatful here in the North, and with it he has built up and firmly established his great school for the colored people of the two sexes in the South. In that school, the students are not merely furnished a book education, but are taught 37 useful trades. Booker Washington has scraped together many hundreds of thousands of dollars in the 25 years, and with this money he has taught and sent forth into southern fields among the colored people 6,000 trained colored men and women, and his student roll now numbers 1,500 names. The Institute's property is worth $1.5 million, and the establishment is in a flourishing condition. A most remarkable man is Booker Washington, and he is a fervent and effective speaker on the platform. Choate and Twain plead for Tuskegee. Brilliant audience cheers them and Booker Washington. Humorist raps tax dodgers, says everybody swears, especially off. Friends of Negro institution trying to raise $1,800,000. To give Booker T. Washington a good start toward collecting the $1,800,000 which he wants to carry back from the North to Tuskegee Institute, Mark Twain, Joseph H. Choate, Robert C. Ogden, and Dr. Washington himself spoke in Carnegie Hall last night. Incidentally, it was a silver jubilee celebration since Tuskegee Institute was founded in 1881. The big house was crowded to its utmost capacity, and there were as many more outside who would have gone in had there been room. The spectacle reminded one of the campaign days last November when District Attorney Jerome and his attendant spellbinders were packing Carnegie Hall. But last night it was by no means a gathering of the populace alone. Women in brilliant gowns, resplendent with jewels, and men in evening dress filled the boxes. Despite the avowed object of the meeting, to get money from the audience and others, there was an atmosphere of good humor and lightheartedness. Mark Twain's teachings were met with such volleys of laughter that the man who never grows old could hardly find intervals in which to deliver his precepts. That part of Mr. Clemens's address which referred to wealthy men who swear off tax assessments was applauded with a special fervor. The occupants of the boxes included Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, Mrs. Henry H. Rogers, Mrs. Clarence H. Mackey, Mrs. Morris K. Jessup, J. G. Phelps Stokes, Isaac N. Seligman, George Foster Peabody, John Crosby Brown, Carl Schurz, Mrs. W. H. Schieffelin, Mrs. William J. Schieffelin, Mrs. Joseph H. Choate, Mrs. Henry Villard, Nicholas Murray Butler, Mrs. Robert C. Ogden, Mrs. Cleveland H. Dodge, Mrs. Alfred Shaw, Mrs. Felix M. Warburg, Mrs. R. Fulton Cutting, Mrs. Collis P. Huntington, Mrs. Robert B. Minturn, Mrs. Jacob H. Schiff, Mrs. Paul M. Warburg, and Mrs. Arthur Curtis James. A Negro octet sang between the speeches. Their songs were old-fashioned melodies and revival songs, and their deep, full voices filled the whole house. William J. Schieffelin opened the meeting by telling its object and urging that all the help possible be given to Dr. Washington. He announced that in April a special train would leave New York for Tuskegee and that the round-trip ticket would cost $50, covering all expenses. On this occasion, the 25th anniversary of the founding of Tuskegee will be celebrated at the school itself by speeches by Secretary of War Taft, President Eliot of Harvard, Bishop Galloway, and Andrew Carnegie. Choate praises Washington. "We assembled tonight," said Mr. Choate when Mr. Schieffelin presented him, "to celebrate the Silver Jubilee of Tuskegee Institute, 25 years old today, the success of which as a nucleus and center of Negro education in the South is the triumph and glory of Dr. Booker T. Washington. I believe he does not claim to be the originator of it. It began in 1881 in a shanty and with 30 pupils. Now, what do we behold? A great educational establishment with 2,300 acres and more than 8 buildings, peculiarly fitted for the tasks they are supposed to assist. It has sent forth more than 6,000 pupils as examples to and teachers of the Negro race. It has now an enrollment of 1,500 pupils and an endowment fund of more than $1 million. Like all the other great educational institutions of today, the more it has and the more it wants, the more it gets and the more it can use. I read that in a recent speech, Dr. Washington declared that he was proud of his race. I am sure his race is proud of him, and I know I can say that the great mass of the American people, both North and South, are also proud of him. And there are few Americans on whom European nations look with such peculiar interest and sympathy as Dr. Washington. It was my pleasure to see him in my own hired house, laughter, in London, surrounded by Englishmen and Englishwomen who were delighted to make his acquaintance and listen to his words. Negro problem a wide one. This tremendous Negro problem, which was left when slavery was abolished and will last much longer than slavery lasted, no more rests on the white people of the South than on the Negroes or on the white people of the North. It was forced upon the South by the irresistible force of the whole nation. In the South, they, white and Negro, have done their part well. I read in a book, which I hope everybody has read, by Mr. Murphy, Secretary of the Southern Education Board, that the illiteracy of the Negroes in the South has been wiped away more than one half since the war. How has it been accomplished? Out of the means of the Southern states. They have done nobly. By taxation, $109 million was raised between 1870 and 1900 for the education of Negroes. How many people in the South, like some people we have had here in New York, stood between the appropriations and the recipients, I do not know, but it was a great achievement. None of the Tuskegee graduates is in an asylum. It is not the educated Negroes who make themselves enemies to the South, it is uneducated Negroes. The desire for these Tuskegee graduates is greater than Tuskegee can satisfy. Integrity of the races. The maintenance of the integrity of the races, which, with approval of both races, has formed the basis of Southern civilization, has given opportunity to Negro lawyers, Negro doctors, and ministers in every profession and industry. And the Negroes are making the most of it. Then Mr. Choate turned toward Mark Twain. "If I were to present the next speaker as Samuel L. Clemens," he said, "some would ask, who is he? But when I present him as Mark Twain..." He could get no further. The applause which broke out lasted a full 3 minutes. "I heard him speak at the dinner on his 70th birthday," continued Mr. Choate, "and the gist of his speech was that he had never done any work in his life. He said he had never worked at anything he didn't like, and so it wasn't work at all. He said that when he had an interesting job before him, he lay in bed all day, and today, I understand, he has been in bed all day."